time you begin the 6 minute in Lime Rock. I'm T2 Romeo India Whiskey, a little late. And for those who would like to ask some questions tonight, give us your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Give me your call letters and names, please.
Julio, Dick, no questions.
And good evening. This is K2KEY.
Attention 1B, but no questions yet.
Whiskey 2, Papa November, Juliet, no questions. Good evening, Dick. Handle is Bob.
Okay, so far we've got Rich, Mel, Barry, Bob. I missed somebody in between there. Who was that other person?
W2TTT, no traffic. It's Gordon.
Okay, we got Rich, Mel, Barry, Gordon, Bob. Anyone else? Check in, give me a call, let us name and a confirming yes if you got a question or a comment.
KC2MDP, no questions.
Okay, Mr. MDP with a no. Boy, I should know your name. Mr. MDP, what is your name, sir?
Name is Steve, Dick.
Very fine, Steve. Okay, we got nobody checking in tonight with questions. Anyone else to check in? Give me a call letter and name, please. Barry, N2MB, there was some form of moon bounce activity this weekend. I wonder if you were involved in it. I think there was a European contest, and there's also a microwave sprint, I think, that took place this weekend. I wonder if you were involved with that. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, I wasn't involved in it. My dad came home from the hospital this weekend, and we've been attending to his needs. He's feeling a lot better, I might add. But I do want to make a comment. I guess everybody is, well, maybe not, familiar with some significant changes which might be taking place in ham radio this week. I guess you know about the highlights of that. I think I just, let me see here. The phone bands are going to be expanded on 75 and 40 meters. Novice Tech and Technician Plus with Element 1 credit licenses will be able to operate in the General Class CW subbands on 80, 40, 15, and 10 meters. There's been some rules to discourage something about vanity calls, multiple vanity calls. I think that's fairly insignificant. Use of spread spectrum will now be permitted from 222 to 225 megahertz. And I think those are the significant ones. And if I had a little bit of a question, if anybody who's a good 75-meter operator around here would know how that's going to affect the DX window on 75 meters. K2RWN2MD.
Okay, I'm not up to speed on this one, Barry. So, phone bands are expanded on 75 meters and 40 meters. The Tech Plus license looks like it's getting an awful lot of the general class privileges. Let's see, 80, 40, 15, and 10. I forgot what's happening there. Vanity calls, multiple vanity calls, that makes some sense. And I guess spread spectrum, the lowest frequency that it's allowed is 222 to 225. I don't think spread spectrum has been used anywhere below that. Was spread spectrum ever used on 432? At one time I know it was 1296 and above. So give us a few more words on all this, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the 80, 40, 15, and 10 meters, that was, the FCC has agreed to allow the Tech Plus, that's a technician with Element 1 credit license, to operate in the general class and CW subbands on 80, 40, 15, and 10 meters. That's what that was about. And the phone expansion, I think that should be mentioned. On 75 meters, generals will be allowed to operate on phone from 3,800 to 4,000 kilohertz. That's an increase of 50 kilohertz for them. Advanced class will be able to use phone from 3,700 to 4,000. That's an increase of 75 kilohertz for them. And the amateur extras will finally get something rather significant. They'll get from 3.6 to 4.0, and that's 150 kilohertz increase for them. That means that they'll now be able to operate in an area which was set aside for DX, for the Canadians, and all that sort of stuff. They'll be able to operate all the way down there, and that's going to significantly affect the DX window and all kinds of stuff, so I don't know how that's going to iron out. On 40 meters, advanced class licenses will be able to operate from 7125 to 7300 kilohertz, an increase of 25 kilohertz for them, and the general class license will be able to operate on voice from 7175 to 7300, and that's an increase of 50 kilohertz for them. Something about 15 meters. On 15 meters, general class operators will have phone privileges from 21275 to 21450, and that's an increase of 25 kilohertz for them. K2RW N2MB.
Well, you know, we're optimistic.
Okay, Rich recognized. Barry, quick question for you. If an extra class licensee is able to operate phone from 3600 to 4000, what's left as a DX window? And here, I'm going to ask a really silly question. I should know, but I don't. Is there a DX window for CW? Is there a DX window for phone? And if the only DX window area left is 3500 to 3600, somewhere in there you either do or don't squeeze CW DX and phone DX. On top of that, I'm of the impression that what modes of operation are allowed on what frequencies, on say for instance 80 meters, is primarily a gentleman's agreement, maybe not necessarily exact FCC law. If for instance in the old days with an extra class license I operated at 3650 in phone with an extra class license, I think I would be in violation of the old gentleman's agreement, but would I really be in violation of FCC law? You probably have more knowledge on this than I do, Mary. Go ahead. N2MB, K2RW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, you would be in violation of FCC rules at that point. Extra class operators can go down to 3750, I think it is. I'll take a look. I'm pretty sure. Hold on. Move phone. They can operate over the whole band, but phone brings them down to 3750 at this time. And the actual window that's set aside just for extras is from 3750 to 3775. That's the little window that was set aside just for the extra class. The DX window, that is a gentleman's agreement. That's not an FCC rule. And the DX window, I believe, is 3790 to 3800. That would be the DX window at this time. So I think they may move that, or I don't know, maybe they'll leave it alone. I'm not sure. Over.
Comment.
Okay. Second person with a comment. We're going to get you right after Rich. Rich first, N2EO, go ahead with your comment.
W2VL repeater.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, still have a cold here. To bear with my horse voice. Well, I see the problem. I primarily work 40 meters CW. The state CW is generally from about 7030 to 7052. You've got the fifth group, which is sort of like the CW equivalent to 1010 on 7052. And the problem we've been running into there is the digital, the RIDI, the PSK31, and all those modes have been pushing down toward the CW band because of the Canadian phone traffic. I think this is going to exacerbate the problem. And, Give the guys on CW some grief, because what's going to happen now is if the phone portions are expanded, the PSK31 and all that stuff is going to come smack on top of it. Back to you, Dick. Leo.
Yeah, they might not be very compatible. The second person with a comment, what was your call letters and name?
That's me, Dick, K2KEY. I was just going to say that I operate a lot of 80 meters, of course. And the DXCW operators usually hang out around between 3,500 and 3,525 down on the low end of the band. And on phone, they all seem to get together at 3795 whenever there's any kind of band opening. It's funny that they get together groups. Like I check in sometimes to that group that's run by a G3 station, and he always has a list of about 15 guys that are on frequency from all parts of Europe, and usually just they call in one after another, you know, get a signal report from you, and then you just give them the whole, you know, give everybody the actually at one time your name, location, what you're using for rig, power and everything like that, and then they just check in one at a time, and that's the way it seems to be night in and night out, Dick. The other groups that used to hang out down in the DX portion of the band only were, you hear them, you know, like nets of DLs or Gs or something like that, but whenever they wanted to work, you know, the stateside and all, they always came up to the 3795 window up there, and they're usually, if any band openings, whatever, you'll find them almost every night of the week. It's amazing that it's been pretty consistent. I'll tell you, I seldom find a night that they're not on there and looking to get reports from North America. Go ahead.
I mean, I can tell, Mel, you're one of the guys really using these frequencies. You and your merry group of men there in Brooklyn, the Kings County Radio Club. What's your overall opinion of this proposed change, or maybe it's an official change? Do you think it's good? Do you think it's a mixed blessing? Will most people like it? Will the Europeans be a little unhappy with us? What do you think is going to happen, Mel? Go ahead.
Believe it or not, I'm about the only one operating out of Brooklyn on 80 meters. And so I get sought after because of especially the county hunters looking for my county. I get a lot of QSL cards, and I can't imagine why they, you know, send many kinds. They actually put a buck in the envelope, so I make sure I, you know, get the mail right back to them directly. And I question that because they said, well, to get this my county on 80 meters, it seems like there's a shortage of 80 meter operators from this area. As far as effect, I don't think so. It's not, believe me, there's not a lot of activity to speak of. Most of the activity above 3,800 are groups that get together every night, same guys, they have their favorite frequency, and they talk about things that, you know, that is more or less, you know, familiar to them that they've discussed over and over again. So usually I only know of one or two groups that I check into. In fact, I used to have my own group on there. Unfortunately, most of them passed away. And so the group broke up. Unfortunately, out of five, four are gone. Three are gone, actually. There's one left. Me and myself and one other is left. That's about it. So we get on once in a while on our regular old net get-together, which used to take place every night at around 11:30 at night until about 1 o'clock in the morning. And people of similar interests, I basically, what it comes down to. So I don't think it's going to have really big effect on anything. They'll just go on doing what they're doing. And the, I could say the DX stations will still hang out around 3795. And it may just show a little bit more activity. I think it'll maybe it'll encourage a little bit more activity on 80 meters. Because I could tell you, the only activity is at night, and there isn't a heck of a lot of it at times, Dick, over.
Tom, I'm hearing a trend here. The western end of Long Island, meaning Brooklyn and Queens, Kings County and Queens County. The serious operators I know of are N2EO, K2KEY, and like an N2MB. All three of you guys, I believe, have capability on 80 meters, but where you're saying that the Brooklyn County seems to be fairly rare, sought after, it would suggest one of three things has happened. The old-timers who like that frequency have moved on to other frequencies or passed away. Number two, the amount of land that people have in those counties in general is not big enough to make it easy to put up an 80-meter antenna unless it's some kind of a compact antenna. I'm having trouble believing that anybody on 80 meters would run into trouble of television interference, TDI. So, in the old days, the western end of Long Island was very well represented on 160, 80, 40. But let's just talk about 80 now. What's the reason that 80 is so lightly represented today? Is it only those reasons I gave, or are there others? You first, Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW in the DECnet.
Well, 80 meters has gotten somewhat of a, 75 meters especially, has gotten somewhat of a, say, a dubious reputation lately in the last few years. There's some groups on there that I wouldn't get involved with. They run right at the edge of what they can get away with the FCC. In fact, some of them have been cracked down on. They just went too far. There was a number of these guys that were broadcasting on AM that were thought they were literally broadcast stations. They got so carried away. There was one, in fact, I can think of that he was actually singing. He was involved in the music industry, and he thought now he could get on with a high fidelity system there and have himself his own broadcast station actually going on the net. And things like that, and others that actually tell you really that you could even join some of them up on the higher end there, where from down south they actually said, you know, no Yankees permitted. So I've heard some things on 75 meters that were not really very nice, and the way they act and operate it, I just got away, tuned away from them. So the ones that more or less, I could say, my own net and the couple other groups down on towards 3800, there are a couple of nice groups that get together, and from time to time I've joined them. And a lot of people, I guess, have listened and said, this is not really my cup of tea anymore. And like you say, a lot of the old timers just, you know, passed on. Either that or they retired to Florida and just don't have the room or not the interest anymore. I've gotten a number of cards in the mail that they for schedules, to set up schedules, so that they can get a QSL card from me. I was quite amazed, but when I questioned them, it's basically because they were county hunters, and they needed my county here, Kings County, to complete a county hunt for maybe 80 meters or whatever, however they were doing it. But I don't find, I tell you, I'm, like I say, quite active on 80 meters. I haven't run across another Brooklynite on 80 meters now in quite a while, over.
Okay, but you're a real operator, and I'm going to ask what are going to be some pretty silly-sounding questions. It turns out the very first contact I ever had in my life, 1956, Morse code, the novice portion of the band, I guess this was around, I took the test in February, probably around April of 1956, on around 3775 kilohertz, wherever the novice band was in those days. I think it was 3750 to 3775. So in that frequency, I made a CW contact from Farmingdale over to Amityville, one town over, probably a total DX of about 7 miles or so, and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I know that 80 meters, when the sun is up, tends to experience a lot of D-layer absorption. In other words, unless you've got a really potent antenna and transmitter, your signal doesn't get very far near high noon on 80 meters. whereas at nighttime, the band can give you some pretty nice DX. And I'm sure it's affected a little bit by the sunspot cycle. I'm guessing it's affected quite a bit by static crashes from thunderstorms in the summertime. So, Mel, what's your best DX at high noon with D-layer absorption? What's your best DX at midnight when there is no D-layer absorption and the ionosphere is hopefully helping you a lot, or maybe it works best at the terminator time? And what's your overall best DX on 80 meters under any conditions? So for us who haven't populated the band in the last 50 years, that's me. Let me think, 50 years? Yes, exactly. 50 years and a couple of months since I made that first QSO. Bring me up to speed as to what is 80 like today and how the laws of physics change a little bit. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I started out in the same place in 1954, Dick. KN2KEY started at 3723. Remember that real well because I found that crystal by luck in a barrel of crystals in New York because when I started ham radio, my entire investment, actually about the only amount of money I had I put into it was about $15, and that was the purchase. A crystal, a key, some wire, and all built the rig actually out of the ARRL book on a wooden chassis and a surplus Hawk 5 receiver that I converted over, which was all, of course, only 80 meters. And at that time, yeah, worked Brooklyn, a lot of Brooklyn contacts all over Brooklyn. I finally made it, I think, to the Bronx and Queens eventually after operating for a number of months. And it was exciting. Listen, I remember it as clear as it was yesterday, you know. You know, it never leaves you, really. I can tell you even who my first contact was. So the novice band at that time was 3700 to 3775. Had to be crystal controlled. You had a maximum power of up to 75 watts, if you remember. You had CW privileges in those days on 80 meters, 40 meters, and 15, and some phone privilege on 2 meters. Your novice license was for 1 year and was not renewable. And, well, my time, you had to take the license, any license that's wanted from novice up, you had to go down to 641 Washington Street. There was no VE or anything like that, strictly at the FCC, anything that you, in the way of licensing. So, 1954, as I said, I started and on 80 meters. I guess I'm still there. As far as DX goes, I'm not on during the daytime. And most likely you won't find much activity daytime. Nighttime, it does pick up, and at times it's been pretty good. I do have DXCC, by the way, on 80 meters. I managed to get the DXCC on 80 meters. It took a number of years, quite a number of years, but I managed it finally. And I was really trying to work the five-band DXCC, and, well, you know, other things happen. That's it. Amateur radio, it's not, you know, my my whole, you know, object in life. It's a lot of fun, and it's a hobby. So, you know, when I have the time, I try to put some time into it as much as possible. But, of course, you know, I'm just joking. It's impossible to, you know, really do a lot of operating under when the conditions are ideal. As far as best DX, well, I guess I could say at least 100 plus countries. So I guess I've covered all of South America, all of Europe, out toward a number of stations in the Middle East and the Pacific. I know I've worked in New Zealand, Australia a number of times. And one time to Japan, only once. I remember the Japanese, the one Japanese station that had a big beam. He had a beam on 75 meters, but I don't hear him on anymore. So that's basically the outlay on 80. It could be surprising. It's, you know, it was very bad this summer. A lot. The noise level was horrendous at times, really horrendous, and I had to just let it go. But at times when it gets quiet, it, you know, as far as atmospheric conditions, you'd be amazed, especially on CW, what you will hear. It's found it's the only band on the HF where, other than maybe 160, where you could actually work DX at times, Dick, over.
KF2L. Okay, Steve recognized. I've got a series of other questions I want to ask you about 80. KF2RL, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, you were asking about daytime DX on 75 meters. I've never really had any DX. I used to talk a lot on 75 meters. I've actually moved to 160 because there's a lot of riffraff that I kind of try and stay away from on 75. But I used to talk high noon. I'd be up to talk, all the way down to Virginia, South Carolina, up to Canadian border, you know, even into Canada. So it's not totally dead during the day. It's just not you're not going to get any kind of European stuff coming in. I think I talked to the same station in Japan. He sent me a picture of a beam that was huge. He used actually the tower sections for the boom. Anyway, that was my comment.
Okay, let me ask you this one, Steve. The D layer, the lowest layer of the ionosphere, on frequencies like 80 meters, and probably, I imagine it's even got some effect on 40, but 80 and below, it probably even affects the AM broadcast band. That's why most AM broadcast transmitters have a daytime power limit and a nighttime power limit. I am guessing that the D layer absorption disappears very rapidly at sundown, at the terminator. So does it disappear abruptly, or does it disappear slowly? In other words, since the sun sets to the west, so to speak, does that mean if your antenna is aimed east, you start picking DX up earlier and to the west later as the D-layer absorption slowly disappears as the sun sets? Give me some words on that one. And also, your best DX stations, I'm guessing your best DX was on Morse code, not necessarily on sideband, but for a guy who's got a really humongous antenna like that, the Japanese guy who has this antenna that's as big as the hold-on five-story apartment building, I think the boom of the antenna is 180 feet long. I believe it's a five-element, fully rotatable 80-meter beam. What kind of DX are you guessing with a kilowatt of power, 1,500 watts peak and low power, what kind of DX do you believe with that antenna he's able to punch through with D-layer absorption at high noon? Any words on this give us a little bit more familiarity would be helpful, Steve. KF2RL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2VL, repeater.
You know, I'm not even sure because I'm not really a big DXer. As far as the difference in signal level, I'll tell you right now, between high noon and let's say, you know, 12 o'clock at night or even 10 o'clock at night is probably about 40 dB as far as, you know, signal level. There's a huge difference, but I'm normally seeing, you know, 40 over dB S9. I mean, yeah, 40 over S9 signals anyway. But I don't know how fast it fades away or comes in, you know what I mean? I'm not on during sunset, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay. My first transmitter, Mel, was, I think, out of Popular Electronics Magazine. It was a 6W6 transmitter, a 6W6 pentode tube, which I think is intended for audio output. That was a crystal-controlled 25-watt transmitter, oscillator transmitter, all in one stage. I'm guessing my rock was somewhere around 3770 or so, and I think I only had one crystal there. It had to be crystal-controlled, couldn't go over 75 watts. I'm running 25 watts with this homebrew. I think you would call it a two-tube transmitter. 6W6 was oscillator and power output, and the rectifier, 5U4? No, I don't think it was a 5U4. Some other kind of very small tube was the tube-type rectifier. And the whole thing was on a chassis, about 6 inches square, and with the tubes, with the tubes. I think the whole thing stood, oh, I would say about 6 or 7 inches. Where you used a ARC-5 transmitter, which was VFO controlled, and it had to be crystal controlled, was there a way that you could modify an ARC-5 and plug a crystal into it? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. No, the ARC-5 was the receiver. It was an ARC-5 receiver aircraft, a square black box. Do you remember that, Dick?
Sure do. Great big fancy dial in the front with nice resolution on it. Very little drift. I'm not sure, but I think it was either made for tank service or aircraft service. Beautiful piece of mil-spec hardware that you could buy on Cortland Street at some very nice prices in those days. So that was your receiver. What was your transmitter, Mel?
That's similar to what you have. I used a 6L6. It may have been a 6W6 that you may have used. I don't know where that... It was a little bit of an auto tube. 6L6 was very common, and 5U4 to rectifier. Actually, I salvaged all the parts. I found a television set in the street, you know, to find a TV set. In those days, they were still not throwing them out, but I found an old 630 chassis that looked like what happened. The picture tube must have been imploded because there was glass all over the thing. And I salvaged out of that, took the 5U4, the power transformer, the filter condensers, the bleeder resistors, the whole business, and put together a rig with that. It was a 6L6, like I say, and the same basically oscillator output, the whole deal, and used the 5U4 as the rectifier. You may have used a 5R4. Some of them used 5R4. The ARC-5 receiver was from an aircraft. Now, it was wired for 24-volt filament and had a 24-volt dynamotor, a little dynamotor that sat on the back of it, plugged in on this little shelf on the back of the radio, and that gave supplied the B-plus for the tubes. So what you had to do is, you weren't going to use 24-volt DC, the best next thing to do, you took the dynamotor off and you rewired the filaments from 12 volts because there actually were 12-volt tubes in series parallel arrangement. So you rewired it for 12 volts and then you built a little power supply to give you about 275 volts of B+. And that's how you converted the radio over. And it worked real well, that radio. Like I say, it had that nice dial on there, very well. Well made, of course, and everything. And for $5, how could you go wrong, over?
WA2CDL Mobile.
CDL Mobile recognized. Andy, ARC-5, when it gets back to you, I'm going to be asking you questions about... was it an AM receiver? Did it have a beat frequency oscillator for Morse code reception? And did it have an RF gain control you could turn down and turn the AF gain control up in order to get single sideband reception with the VFO? Many of those older receivers, before they had a real product detector intended for single sideband, you had to juggle the knobs in order to get good single sideband reception, like I said, by turning the RF gain down so as not to overload the VFO mixer stage. The beat frequency oscillator was the thing that converted the Morse code carrier into a tone, and by adjusting that VFO knob, you could adjust the pitch of the tone you heard. You could tune it on the high side or the low side, make it a high pitch, low pitch, whatever is your favorite. Andy, tell us what your first rig was like, and what year was it? As you can tell, Mel's first rig, I'm not sure of mine now if it was a 6W6 or a 6L6. And the 5U4 was the large rectifier tube for powering a whole great big television set. There was a smaller version. Maybe it was 6W4, 6R4, one of those smaller version octal tubes that wasn't as big in diameter as the 5U4. The V2CDL, go right ahead, Andy. What was your first rig like?
Question?
All right, let me just make sure I'm not doubling.
Yeah, questioner, we'll pick you up right after Andy's comment. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay. Good evening. Haven't been on in a while. I've been pretty busy with a lot of other things going on. and came in because I want to ask you a question, Dick, about an antenna. Get your opinion on this. But I don't want to change the subject right away, so we'll continue this. We'll come back to that. My first rig, from what I recall, was actually homemade, and I still have it. It's a one-tube transmitter that simply puts out an unmodulated carrier, and I use it on CW. In fact, my first contact, my very first contact, was with it, and on 40 meters. It puts out about 15 watts. It uses a 6AQ5, which is an audio output tube, beam power type. And with a little 40-meter dipole, I was able to work a station in Manchester, England. And that's when I first got licensed. I was operating CW, and it worked out pretty good. And it was only a transmitter, with key clicks at all. It wasn't something famous or elaborate. It was just something I threw together, and it worked. And I forget the receiver I was using. I think it was a Hall of Fest's SX-101 or something like that for a receiver. But I remember I had to switch over manually at the time between transit and receive. I didn't have a Dalkey relay set up. I forget how I was doing that. Some kind of crazy scheme that I thought about. You know. So, and that was it. That's what I used. But I played around with all the other stuff that you told me about, of course. So, brought back some memories there, Dick. Back to you. And then when you're done, I'll ask an antenna question, which I think you'd like.
Glad to hear that. And that SX-100, is that the one with two very large dials? The left-hand dial was the coarse frequency dial, and the right-hand dial was the vernier dial. And in 1956, 57, brand new, I think that receiver was around $200 or $300 brand new. Is that true, Andy?
W2ZL repeater.
No, yeah, I know which one you're talking about, but the one that I used, the Holocraft, is had a slide rule dial. Didn't have a round dial where the numbers disappear. This was just a slide rule from left to right, as you're familiar with. I remember it had the band spread. It was broken into two sections. You had a slide rule in the top portion and a slide rule in the bottom portion. One was the band spread, one was the main tuning. And I believe that's what I used.
Okay, we got Andy listed for a questioner. The other person who wants to ask a question, give us your call letters and your name, sir.
Yes, KT2LG Washington. My name is Rich.
Okay, K2 Lima Tango Yankee and name Rich. Okay, we'll get to you right after. We're going to come back to this nostalgia thing that we're having tonight about 80 meters and our very first rigs. Looks like Andy's very first contact was on 40 meters CW. Mel and I, our first contact were one-tube transmitters, cathode keyed. And you had to be a little bit careful. You didn't put your fingers across the Morse code key because you would get 50 or 80 volts or something like that. The cathode would go to when the key was up. So, Andy, hit us with your antenna question. W2CDL, the technical maven of Limark, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thanks. Yeah, that's the other project we're working on, of course. Say hello to Mel, too, and anyone else. And that call you just heard was KC2, LTY Rich. KC2. And hello, Rich, because I know him also. Here's my situation. Well, actually, it's a very simple one, but just a little bit puzzling here. I'm in the process of putting together a Mosley TA-33. Very familiar and popular antenna. And this one has the walk band addition to it, which is an extra element. What they do is they have two driven elements. It's normally a three element antenna. And what they do is they add a fourth element with a phasing line. They call it a Q match. They call it a military Q match is their word for it. And they add an extra element for the walk bands, and that's it. And they play place that element between the reflector and the driven element, the normal driven element. And I have two driven elements side by side, spaced a certain distance apart. Now this antenna, I'm sure you're familiar with it, if they call it a trap master antenna, because all the elements are trapped. There are eight traps total, because there's four elements, two traps per element. And, of course, you get into discussion of how the antenna works electrically. But what's interesting is that they state in the instructions the traps are color-coded, and they say if you reverse the trap, because you can reverse it, it physically it looks very symmetrical, and when you assemble the antenna for the first time, you can insert the trap in any direction. But they say not to. They say if you turn the trap around and have the color code facing the wrong way, they say the antenna will not resonate and it won't work. Now, the question is, obviously the trap is not a symmetrical trap, or is it? Why would they state that you can't turn the trap around? Because I didn't open it up to see how this trap is designed, but I'm kind of curious, since it looks symmetrical, electrically, what is it really doing? How's that for a question, Dick?
I know what it's worth on.
Dick and 2EO.
Okay, we got both Mel and Rich on that one. Mel sounds like he's been there. I bet you've seen the inside of one of those traps. What's in there, Mel? K2KUI in the group, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thanks. I had the experience with the beam. We inherited a beam in a field day. One of the reasons we inherited it. They took the traps apart. What they were trying to do, God only knows, make out of this beam. So they gave me the beam and said, in fact, the beam was really brand new, clean, just that it was messed around with. So I started having the traps open. I see what they do. The traps are not unified wound. They're slightly wound on a sort of a, I would say sort of like crimp turns. In other words, some of the turns, the turns at one part of the trap, one end of the trap, are wider than the other. And the reason that they do that is because the dielectric of the center where it's wound on, it acts as a capacitor. In other words, they are trying to balance the reactance of capacitor and the inductance of the antenna of the trap. They're trying to cancel it that way. It's doing a little bit of a magic. I was a little puzzled at first until I could say looked at it closely, some measurements. But the inductive and the capacitive reactance, so called, is somewhat tuned out by that method. I can say a little bit of a balance, but seems to work pretty good, Dick. Once I got everything back the way it's supposed to, the beam performed real well. Over.
Hey, Studio. Rich recognized, and I'm guessing that when you put that trap in backwards, because it is tapered in impedance internally by tapering the diameter, the diameter of the turns, the spacing of the turns, the dielectric constant of the bobbin it's wound on, you really have a kind of distributed resonator, distributed trap, and therefore on different frequencies, it's going to behave differently depending on which direction. When you go to the higher frequencies where the trap has to change the electrical length of your relevance, the null point in the center of the trap will make a difference. So that's part of what's going on. Rich, N2EO, what do you remember seeing? What do you remember seeing inside of those traps, Rich?
Okay, Dick. It's actually two traps in one. There's a 15-meter trap in one housing. So if you turn it around, you have to have a 20-meter trap first, then the 15, you have the whole element for 20. If you turn it around, it will work.
Okay, so it's multiple traps in theory, and the right one's got to be in the the right location. So that makes some sense as to why it can't be used backwards. You have this Mosley TA-33, how long, Andy? And when's it going up in the air?
All right. Yeah, it's going to go up shortly, but I'll talk to you more about that. I'm just curious, it brings up an interesting question. First of all, here, I understand, and that's what I figured. There's got to be something with the windings that is making it cheap to the electrical performance inside. Basically, as far as the antenna is concerned, I'm assuming that direction of current flow into the trap is always the same as the antenna, as the parasitic, I'll call it a parasitic element, because obviously that's how it transfers the field from the director to the reflector, which is trapped, or the driven element, or the director, rather, which is trapped. So I'm assuming that the current has to be in one direction because the trap is not symmetrical. And although I don't really have a straight answer yet, I guess it has something to do with the Q of the trap. They say this is a high Q resonator, and because of that, you have to be careful with ground effects, which I can understand. Even when you tune this antenna, they want it at least 15 to 20 feet above the ground to properly check its VSWR across the band, and it should be under 2 to 1. I'm just assuming they do it this way because of they want a higher Q and probably a broader, flatter range over the bandwidth of the antenna. But I assume to be that to be correct. And as far as the antenna going up, as I mentioned, next few weeks, with a little bit of time. Back to you, Dick.
Well, a good three-element Yagi, based on the measurements I've made in a good laboratory, at 915 megacycles, is capable of quite a bit more than 6 dB over isotropic, maybe 6.5 dB of three-element Yagi, and maybe even a little bit beyond that. The main principle of operation of the three elements is a kind of dual-directional interferometer. The director is emitting a signal, the driven element is emitting a signal, and the director signal is delayed in time by an amount that equals the distance in space. In other words, if your director was 90 degrees a quarter wavelength physically ahead of the driven element, then you would arrange its length so that parasitically it picked up a signal and re-radiated it 90 degrees delayed. So if it's spatially delayed by 90 degrees and electronically delayed by 90 degrees, then the signal in that direction from the driven element and the signal in that direction from the director add together in a voltage manner. Almost every antenna fires in the direction of phase delay, opposite of common sense. Until you really study it, you would think an antenna would fire in the direction of phase lead. They always fire in the direction of phase lag. And the reflector, being made longer than the driven element, runs slightly inductive. That means it leads in phase. So any signal that tries to go in the direction toward the reflector and keep on going is going to be interfered with on the signal that's being re-radiated by the reflector. So in that direction, you get partial cancellation, but the signal radiated by the reflector, well, a portion of it goes forward, goes through the driven element, and encounters the driven element, which by comparison to the reflector, driven element is delayed. That gives you an addition. And then the signal continuing to go forward encounters the signal being re-radiated by the director, and it also is lagging in phase and adds together. So if you had a real good set of sharp eyes that operated at these frequencies, you would see three points of emission, reflector, driven element, and director. And from your point of view down the bore site in front of the signal, it would appear, in front of the antenna, it would appear that all three signals are coming toward you, adding in a co-phase manner. Whereas when you stood behind the antenna, you would again see three emitters, but the three emitters from those three elements are tending to cancel each other. And that's really the process by which you get a pretty big null in the pattern toward the back of the antenna and a pretty big broad peak toward the front. When it comes to 2, 3, 4, and 5 element Yagis, the interferometry effect is the dominant effect. That's the main process by which the gain is happening, the co-phase and antiphase characteristic of the re-radiation of the elements. Turns out that an awful lot of what Mother Nature's physics works on is absorption and re-radiation. We all talk about the ionosphere reflecting a signal. And if I was on 10 gigahertz right now and a rainstorm was happening, I would talk about the reflection I get from the raindrops of a cloud that's out there in front of my antenna. We all use those words. You dig one step deeper into what's really happening, you'll find out that those raindrops are absorbing the 10 gigahertz signal as if they were a spherical miniature dipole. You set up an oscillation in the droplet of water, believe it or not, and that droplet of water with that oscillation at 10 gigahertz excited by your signal that hit it, it re-radiates. So from the outside, when you make the measurement, it looks like it's a signal bounce. It's absorption and re-radiation. And primarily, the ionosphere is also doing that. Now, the way you can really prove that it's not just simple reflection, but it's absorption and re-radiation, is in the case of a horizontally polarized signal hitting a rain cloud. If, for instance, I had my antenna aimed dead north, and if dead north of me, 50 miles away, there's a rain cloud, obviously I'm going to get a big reflection off of it, and lots of people in lots of directions aiming their antennas at that rain cloud are going to hear my signal. But for that poor guy that is directly east of the rain cloud, he gets nothing. And you'd say to yourself, how come every other direction gets a signal, but the guy that's dead east of the cloud or dead west of the cloud gets nothing when I'm horizontally polarized? When I'm vertically polarized on my 10 gig transmitter, the guy that's dead east and dead west of the rain cloud gets a beautiful signal. And you say to yourself, how in the heck can that happen? Well, make believe you're isolating one single raindrop in that cloud that's dead north of you. And your signal hits that raindrop, and it sets up a horizontally polarized signal in the raindrop as if the raindrop was a horizontally polarized dipole, as if it was a piece of metal in space where the piece of metal runs east and west. That's the way I'm exciting that raindrop. The poor guy that's off to the dead east of the rain cloud, he's off the end of the dipole. That's where there's a null for horizontal polarization. If I'm running vertical polarization, the cloud is acting, each little raindrop is re-radiating as if it's a ground plane antenna, which is omnidirectional, so that everybody in every direction will hear the reflection off the round rain cloud if I'm running vertical. This phenomenon created one heck of an argument between the guys in California versus the guys in New York as we first started getting on 10 gigs and the bandwidth started becoming popular around 1985 or so. The guys in California said, you guys in New York are crazy. For traditional reasons, you DX enthusiasts have always used horizontal polarization on the VHF frequencies, starting on 10 meters, 6 meters, and 2 meters. Although back in World War II, quite a few guys would have great big wooden collinear antennas with ropes outside the window of the shack, and you pulled out the ropes so that the whole antenna rotated between horizontal and vertical polarized. You make a schedule on 80 meters. Right after World War II, with a guy with 2 meters with his SCR 584 transmitter, and the first thing you talk to each other on 80 meters before you go up to 2 meters to continue the QSO is, hey, Andy, are you horizontal or vertical? And I'm going to adjust my antenna accordingly. Well, for a bunch of reasons, we've all settled on horizontal polarization 90-some-odd percent of the time. But there was a period of time when the guys in California said, we're going to go vertical, particularly with the Polarplexer transmitters that they were using in those days. So an awful lot of what looks like reflection really is absorption and re-radiation, and that's exactly what's going on with the parasitic elements of a 3, 4, and 5 element Yagi. The majority of the signal gets there, gets absorbed by the parasitic element. The parasitic element re-radiates that signal, but it creates a phase shift in the process, depending on whether the element is tuned high or tuned low by being a little bit short or a little bit long of the resonant frequency. When it comes to really long Yagis, your 10, 15, 20, and all the way up to 102 elements, the longest commercially made Yagi antenna